All right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right. One week I'm going to come in, I'm going to say a different name and see how many people pick up on it. Yeah. Yes, my name is Smiggle, and and I'm doing the Michael Slate Show. Michael will be in, I don't know when. Anyway, we have just a packed show for you today. And at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Dr. J. Corey Williams, the resident physician in psychiatry at Yale University. And we'll be talking with him about his article, a really powerful article called The Oppressive Seeds of the Colin Kaepernick Backlash. Before that, we'll be talking with Anne Wright. And we're going to be talking with Anne about the women's boat to Gaza. Anne's an activist and former U.S. ambassador who resigned when the U.S. began to attack Iraq back in 2003. And she's going to be talking about her recent role, her recent adventure as one of the captains of the women's boat to Gaza. All right, so that'll be a very interesting, very, very interesting conversation. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Henry Giroux. Henry's the author of America at War with Himself and many other books. He's also the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. And his book is just a hell of a good book. I really enjoyed reading it, although I'll tell you, it's got me going back and forth. Henry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure. And you got to notice, Henry, I have 1,000 different colors of ink on things, and where I underline something and I say something next to it, and then I go back and go, wait a minute, no. But I think it's a really interesting book and a really compelling book.
I'm delighted. It's one of my favorite books.
Uh-huh. Okay.
My own books. I really like this book a lot. I think it speaks to something very crucial in terms of what's happening in American politics.
Well, let's talk about what is this very crucial thing that's happening in American politics?
Well, I think American politics is on the brink of basically tipping into an authoritarian society. I think we've basically never seen anything as visible and as cruel, as militant, and as warlike. I mean, all of a sudden we have two parties, one of which, of course, represents the epitome of a kind of over-the-top authoritarianism, and the other is kind of an authoritarianism being wrapped in democratic values. But I think that the presence of Trump, what we've really seen is, for the first time, a candidate that unapologetically, rather than disguises ideology, is basically declaring war on a number of institutions in the United States that basically are invaluable for supporting what we might call a democracy. And he's declaring war on women and civil liberties, declaring war on youth, on blacks, on immigrants, and Syrian refugees. I mean, this guy has just created a huge swath of what I would call disposable populations. I think the underlying violence that basically comes out of his discourse is actually terrifying. And we've not only seen examples of that violence at his rallies, whether he's talking about punching people in the face or talking about the good old days when people were carried out on stretches, but in the third debate with Clinton, I mean, to actually say that he might not accept the results of the election and to suggest that basically imply that what in the event of that, of course, except if he wins, in the event of that, that he might be a party to civil violence and civil disorder. I mean, that's just amazing. I mean, it doesn't get worse than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could. It could get worse. Let's just keep our eyes on
that. I mean, it doesn't get worse than that, at least in terms of the language.
Right. No, I'm just teasing. Because you got to laugh to keep from yelling. That's the point right now, and actually we should be doing more yelling. And, you know, one of the things that your book does is it really does shout out to people. I wanted to ask you this, because there is an element, even with Trump, and, you know, people look at Hillary Clinton, and I agree with your assessment of this. And, you know, Hillary Clinton, every time I look at her, there's this, you know, not just the stuff that she's done with all the billionaires and whatnot, but this is a woman who was really engineering a whole lot of mass murder around the world, and including the thing where she did that whole, you know, the sanctions that resulted in the death of 500,000 Iraqi kids and all that, and they said it was all right and all this other stuff. You're looking at her, and then your other choice is this fascistic ass, basically. And
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, for a lot of people, they look at it, and a lot of people I've talked to, they're concerned, but they still have this thing of like, well, look, it can't happen here. There's checks and balances that are going to actually stop and step in here. It can't happen here. And you pose things very differently. Can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, the issue here is not so simple. It's not so black and white. It's not the lesser evil theory at all. It seems to me that we have to begin with a basic assumption, and the assumption is the system is broken. It's run by money, it's run by the financial elite, and both parties are utterly corrupt. So the issue here is that I'm not endorsing Hillary Clinton. What I'm fighting against is the most immediate possibility of an authoritarian state in which thousands of people would be thrown under the bus, 11 million people would be exported. We don't know what it means in terms of a call for law and order that talks about the good old days. Remember the good old days when basically people were lynched, black people were lynched, mm-hmm. when young people were basically ripped from counters in the South and dogs were set upon them? You remember COINTELPRO? When Fred Hampton was killed and the FBI was infiltrating, it seems to me, all kinds of radical groups, in the most immediate sense, that has to be stopped. In the longer sense, the longer strategy is to have at least some room with Clinton, who I don't believe would impose those policies domestically and has been pushed somewhat to the center given her language. But the contradictions will emerge under Clinton, and that's what we've got to seize upon to build a third party. Here, and to move away from the assumption that capitalism and democracy are basically the same thing.
Here's the whole question. And that's something, actually, we're going to have you on again, and we're going to have to join that conversation in another point, because I really want to dig into this in particular, this thing about what's happening now. And when I was started to read your book, there was this whole point about the various forms of fascism. There's soft fascism. And you make a point that totalitarianism is deeply woven into the fabric of U.S. society, and people don't really look at it as a totalitarian state, you know, but you're talking about how it's actually deeply woven into the fabric of the society. Can we talk about that a little?
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of... I remember this is a society built on genocide. I mean, and it isn't as if that legacy has simply been overcome. I mean, this is a society built on slavery. I mean, this is a society in which we've seen all kinds of events happen historically over time, from whether we're talking about the Palmer Raids to whether we're talking about the McCarthy period to whether we're talking about the internment of the Japanese. I mean, we have a long legacy of violence in this country, and I think in many ways there have been attempts to somewhat confront that violence historically. But I think that starting in the 1980s, we saw a major kind of shift in American politics. And what that shift was that we no longer cared about the common good. We no longer cared about public goods. We no longer cared about public values. We no longer cared about notions of solidarity not built on commodified relations or relations of exchange. You have a new class of financial elite that come into power that in many ways are beginning to consolidate class power in their hands in ways that drives not just the economy, but all of social life. Every matter becomes reduced to an act of commerce. The only available form of citizenship is consumption. War now is no longer an extension of politics. Politics is an extension of war. We create a war culture. We create a war culture that's market-driven. And what gets missing from that culture, and can never be missing from any democracy, is an ethical concern for the other. All of a sudden, economic activity, political activity, social activity is removed from social cost. The question of value, the question of justice, the question of compassion now gets moved to the margins of society in ways in which a culture of cruelty begins to emerge. Welfare people are mooches. Public servants are jerks. The homeless people deserve to be homeless. We know this language. This is a language that breeds hatred. It's a language that breeds bigotry. It's a language that is antithetical to every notion of democracy that matters. And Trump is simply symptomatic of that language. To get rid of Trump is to not get rid of the problem, the real problem of the forces that created him. And we know what they are. We know that the Republican Party has been basically involved in the worst forms of racism, the worst forms of misogyny, I mean, the worst forms of anti-democratic behavior. Just think about what it means to all of a sudden find yourself in a country where people are trying to overthrow the 13th Amendment. I mean, they're eliminating voting rights for minorities. How is that possible, given the gains that we've made for so long? So those forces in totalitarian forces have been coupled with not only a culture of cruelty, they've been coupled with the worst assault on reason we have ever seen. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? We now are claiming that creationism is comparable in terms of its intellectual value to evolution in the schools, that books are being censored because they're not patriotic enough, that in fact emotion becomes more important than reason, and that you have a presidential candidate who actually says publicly that he likes people who are stupid. Then you have a celebrity culture that confers the worst form of authority and idiocy upon mass culture. That's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Henry Giroux, who's the author of America at War with Itself, and it's a really, I'm telling you, folks, you got to pick this up and read it, and you'll be just like as you're sitting here listening to Henry talk now. I'm sure a lot of you are like scribbling things down and trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to pursue this? And it's actually a very important book for people to read today because it's speaking to, look, these are perilous times. These are times that we have not seen before, okay? And great change is both possible and good or bad. It's possible. But one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, too, is that when you were just talking about this question of sort of what's going on with Trump and how the lowest common denominator and all the kind of stuff that he's doing, there's also a point in your book where you talk about the role of manufactured ignorance in society, which is really important, I think, especially because there's the manufactured ignorance, and then there's the things that sort of spring off of that or surround it, which is things like the changes that have happened in the schools and the prisons, especially for people from oppressed nationalities.
Yeah. I like to talk about it as armed ignorance. It's really, ignorance has become the self-portrait of power. What I mean by that, when you look at all the major institutions that are engaged in education, whether you look at public schools, which are under enormous assault and have been since the 1980s by the right, in which schools all of a sudden are turned into disimagination factories. They're places where kids, the imagination of young people are basically squashed in the interest of teaching for the test, in the interest of accountability schemes, in the interest of schemes that are so empiricized and instrumentalized that they become death factories for the imagination. These are institutions that are designed to make people stupid and to basically get them to conform to a society in which power is never held accountable. Secondly, it seems to me, when you look at higher education and the assault that that's been under, consistently defunded in ways to compensate for the lowering of taxes for the corporate rich, but also in a sense to dismantle those schools and to make sure that they don't pose a threat by creating critical intellectuals who could actually become engaged citizens. And one of the ways in which that defunding has worked, as you know, is to place thousands upon thousands of young people in debt. And it seems to me that that debt in itself is a way to kill any sense of critical agency, because kids come out of those institutions and it takes them years to be able to make up what it means to be able to pay off those loans. And they're not going to take jobs in the public service. They're going to take jobs that enable them to pay off their loans. And I can understand that. But I think that's a very systemic, tactical sort of intervention. Thirdly, you have think tanks being funded by the right all over the country, whether we're talking about the Koch brothers funding curricula, educating the new right students so that they can go into the schools, or creating chairs in schools that demand that faculty be hired who believe in a free market fundamentalism. Then you have the cultural apparatuses. Then you have the corporate media controlled by five or six major corporate entities, which basically are the major educational tools, in my estimation, in the world today. This collapse of power and culture, or the merging of power and culture, is like something we've never seen before. I mean, these are basically institutions for the dissemination of a new form of public pedagogy. These are truly disimagination machines. And when you ask your readers and your listeners, to provide funds to keep you going, I can't say strongly enough how important that is, because the alternative media may be one of the few sites left where the possibilities for imagining what a democracy might look like can take place. You cannot have a democracy if you do not have informed citizens. It is not going to happen. And this ignorance, this armed ignorance that we're talking about, is really a way to cripple agency, to cripple choice, to cripple imagining a future which is very different than the present.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask is, because you mentioned this a couple times in the book, and you say this thing about basically what kind of society. The question isn't so much about who is Trump and what is he doing, but there's also a bigger question there. That is the question, but then there's a bigger question of actually what kind of society would produce something like a Trump?
You bet. I mean, that's what's so scary. I mean, let's think about some of these issues. For instance, you have a society marked by a culture of fear, especially since 9/11. This is a breeding ground for hate. The culture of fear functions in a way, it seems to me, to legitimate a culture of cruelty, and one in which shared responsibilities are replaced by shared fears. Secondly, you have a celebrity culture, and I cannot emphasize this enough. You have a celebrity culture that basically cheapens serious and thoughtful discourse. putting into play a focus on lifestyles, personalities. It devalues politics. It treats politicians as celebrities. It refuses to give them a serious hearing. And the spectacle, in that sense, then becomes the ultimate face of power. And nobody has embodied this more than Trump. Absolutely no one. I mean, the first primary he appeared in, Republican primary, debate, they attracted 22 million people. Up to that point, they had been attracting 2 million people, which gives you some idea of the way in which this culture confers authority and arms ignorance, if I may put it that way. Secondly, it seems to me, you have a Republican Party that for the last 40 years has been stoking what I would call its followers to be angry, but not about issues that matter. I mean, about issues that basically are transformed into hate, transformed into bigotry, racism. Couple that with an economy that is marked by massive inequality and wealth and power and cares so little for the social contract that it absolutely refuses to even fund programs for poor kids, food programs for poor kids in the schools that would gladly devalue, it seems to me, or eliminate Social Security and Medicare, that makes the claim that the only choices that matter are made by individuals and that all consequences that individuals face are strictly their responsibility. This is a discourse of madness. I mean, the cities have been deindustrialized, jobs have been shipped overseas, politics now is separated from power, power is global, you have a global elite. Politics is local. It has no control over containing that power. The state has been taken over by corporate entities, the bankers and others now basically controlling the economy with impunity. And hence you have, with the death of the social state, the rise of the police state. You have the punishing state. Imagine, you know, as you well know, Michael, I mean, this is a system that is not marked any longer by compassion. It's marked by mass incarceration. That's what it's marked by. I mean, the institutions that matter in this country are now the military, are now the mass incarceration system, are now the police, who are now inhabiting schools, more police in schools increasingly than the teachers. So it seems to me there's been a long-term development of those forces, economic, political, intellectual, symbolic, that have worked to create a Frankenstein. And that Frankenstein is a society that no longer believes that democracy matters.
One of the things that you talk about, too, coming off of that, which I think is really important, because I was going to ask you about this whole question of the whole fact, the fact of the role of the military in society and culture and everything else. I mean, it is amazing how much of the military is there. And then I wanted to link that, too, though, with this one thing that you've mentioned in your book a couple of times, is that one of the things with Trump is the willingness to do the unthinkable, and that there's a shifting boundary of what is accepted as normal and that the unthinkable is now thinkable. Let's talk about that.
Well, let's talk about that and provide just simply one instance. I mean, look. When you have a person running for the presidency of the United States who embraces willingly what I would call a war crime, then you have to sit back and ask yourself what the implications of that are. This is a guy who supports torture. He supports torture. I mean, this is a guy who calls for racial profiling as a national policy. This is a guy who invokes the good old days when people were beaten to death as protesters, or certainly maimed in many ways. I mean, this is a guy who has crossed the line. He basically has brought into play the unthinkable, but people don't understand that what the unthinkable is not just simply an expression of thoughtlessness, but it's an ideology and a policy that really we've seen before. We saw it with Pinochet in Chile. We saw it basically in Germany under Adolf Hitler. We saw it with Mussolini. And the end point of that policy are two things. One, the utter suppression of dissent. And secondly, the camp. People end up in prisons. People end up disappearing. This is the politics of disappearance, the disappearance of justice, the disappearance of democratic institutions, the disappearance of black and brown people who are trouble, the disappearance of journalists who speak truth to power, the disappearance of students who cause trouble in the streets. That's why it's so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, I think we have time for one more question. I wanted to get to this because it's true. You're looking at what Trump is there now. And whether or not he got elected or gets elected, whatever happens, Trump is there on the scene now. And everything that he represents is there now. It's out of the bottle. It's functioning in society. And it's actually attracting a certain social base. And you make a point, though, that no matter what happens off of this, that there's a reality that Trump is not an aberration, but a successor to a whole line of fascists and a symptom of a much larger reality. Let's talk about that in closing.
What Trump has done is that he has taken the elements of extremism that were allegedly on the margins of American society and made them the central of politics. He has a campaign manager, as you know, Bannon, Steve Bannon, who is an outright racist. There's no other way to talk about him. He's basically the poster boy for the alt-right. I mean, here's a guy who put up a site on his site celebrating the Confederate flag after those nine people were killed in the church. I mean, claiming this is the real face of America. I mean, this is frightening. And the real question is, now that these forces have been unleashed, now they're at the center of American politics, and now that they've been legitimated by this fool, what happens? How do you now contain them? What's the next step? How do you talk about these forces in American society as anything other than forces that basically are wedded to forms of domestic terrorism? We need a new language for them. And I think the language that we have to rescue the language of radical democracy so that we can make visible those threats that basically become normalized as part of American politics, American culture, and American entertainment.
All right, Henry Giroux, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Michael. Yes. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, you too, man. And sometime you're going to find your way out to L.A., and we'll sit down for an entire hour and just talk.
Right? I would
That'll
love that.
All right, well, let's
I
do
would
it.
Love that.
All right, Henry, thank you very much, man.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Henry Giroux, author of America at War with Itself, and he's the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. I want to say one thing, actually, which I think is really important. Off of this thing with Henry, just something I was thinking about from Bob Avakian, which says, for all of us who are worried about it, who are thinking about what the hell is going to happen in the world today, how do we change this? Three things that have to happen in order for there to be a real and lasting change for the better. One, people have to fully confront the actual history of this country and its role in the world up to today and the terrible consequences of this. Two, people have to dig seriously and scientifically into how this system of capitalism and imperialism actually works and what this actually causes in the world. And three, people have to look deeply into the solution to all this. Again, that's from Bob Avakian on May 1st of this year. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Anne Wright talking about the women's boat to Gaza, so stay tuned. Welcome back. And Anne Wright, you're going to have to help me with that. I'll ask you about that in just a minute. But it was a song written by women who were on the women's boat to Gaza. I was really moved by that song, and I thought it was an extremely important piece. Anne Wright is a 29-year U.S. Army, Army Reserves veteran. She's a retired United States Army colonel and retired State Department official. And she's known for her outspoken opposition to the Iraq War, as well as her, I'll tell you, she's really known for all the really daring and courageous things that she's done over the last 20 years and a whole lot of other things. But she was also a passenger on the Challenger 1, which along with the Mavi Marmara was part of the Gaza flotilla. And the Mavi Marmara was the boat that was actually nine people were killed on that back a number of years ago. And she's the co-author of the book, Dissent, Voices of Conscience. And boy, does she dissent and boy, is she a voice of conscience. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's really good to hear your voice again. It's been a while, so I'm really looking forward to this. The woman's boat to Gaza. What was this about? What was it, and who was on the boat?
Well, it was a mission to bring international attention to the fact that the Israeli government still has an illegal, dangerous blockade on this little place called Gaza. Not only a land blockade, but a naval blockade, where three sides of Gaza, this little tiny area, 25 miles long, 5 miles wide, is essentially just isolated from the world because of Israel and Egypt on the southern side of Gaza. But it's primarily the Israeli blockade that has imprisoned now over 2 million people live in Gaza. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. So our mission was to bring international attention by putting women on a boat and taking a long voyage. This was 1,715 miles, starting in Barcelona, Spain, going first to Ajaccio, Corsica, France, and then down to Messina, Sicily, Italy. And then the last leg of it was 1,000 miles from Messina on to offshore of Gaza. We got 35 miles from Gaza when the Israeli occupation forces, as we call them, stopped us in international waters on the high seas, kidnapped us, took us against our will to Israel, stole our boat, and then charged us with entering Israel illegally when we were saying, you kidnapped us, we didn't want to even be here, but charged us with entering Israel illegally and then deporting us from Israel.
Well, there's so much to dig into here. Again, let's talk about this, though. Who was on the boat?
Well, we had on the last leg of it, well, on each of the three legs of it, we had 13 women, three crew, a tremendous captain that we had from Australia who has extensive international experience, captaining experiences of Greenpeace boats and of Medicine Sans Frontiere boats that have been picking up refugees, migrants in the Mediterranean for several years. She was our captain, and then we had two crew members, one from Norway, one from Sweden. And in fact, the two crew members are the ones that wrote the song that you played in the very, very beginning, a song to the women of Gaza. And we will not be silent until you are free is really the capturing line of that song.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song, very powerful song. Why a woman's boat in particular? I mean, other flotillas that have gone, other boats that have gone over there over the years have been general population boats, but why a woman's boat to Gaza?
Well, we decided this time, since, as you mentioned, we've had a lot of other ships that have gone, starting in 2008 when the Free Gaza Movement actually were able to get five voyages of boats, small boats, into Gaza before, in early 2009, the Israeli forces began stopping them forcefully, I mean, ramming their boats and almost sinking them. And then in 2010, the six boats with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, with the attack on the Mavi Marmar, as you mentioned, where nine people were killed, actually executed, and 50 others were wounded. And then in 2011, we had 10 ships that were going to sail to Gaza, but the Israelis paid off the Greek government not to let the ships sail from Greece, even though several of us tried to break free and got about 5 miles offshore Greece before the Greek commando stopped us. Then in late 2011, we had two boats that actually left from Turkey and then were stopped. In 2012, we had another boat. 2013, another boat. 2015, we had four boats that attempted to go. So we've had a lot of boats, a lot of international attention, which is the point of this whole thing. But, you know, on one level, it was like, well, we've already done that. We need something new that will capture international media attention. And so we thought, well, why not send a boat of women? So on the last leg of this mission, we had a Nobel Peace Laureate, Mairead McGuire from Northern Ireland. We had two members of parliament, one from the Algerian parliament, one from the New Zealand parliament. On previous legs of the voyage, we'd had members of parliament from Spain and Sweden and Tunisia. Of course, we don't have a member of the U.S. Congress or legislatures because they're too afraid of losing their money support for coming out on such a mission. And so I was the only American on it, although there have been plenty of Americans who would have been thrilled to be on it, to represent our country and so many people, millions of people in our country who are totally opposed to the U.S. support for the state of Israel, no matter what criminal acts it does.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that in an article you wrote about this particular trip, you did a very poetic thing where you described actually looking out from the boat and as you were captured and looking out and seeing darkness and the comparison between the darkness and the lights in what was Israeli territory. But then you talk about the darkness in this. And I wanted you to talk about that, because it really raises a lot of things, including what are the conditions for the people in Gaza. When you talked about that, I was really, really moved by just the idea that here's this dark black spot that actually is filled by, you know, millions of people and people who are living just on the edge of survival because of what's being done to them by the Israeli regime.
we were captured by the Israeli about 4 in the afternoon. And as it took another 8 hours for us to be brought into the Israeli port of Ashdod. And as we started approaching the shores of Israel and Gaza, it was so distinct. I mean, right in front of us was the last Israeli town before you get to Gaza, and that town is Ashkelon. And you can see the 3 big smokestacks of the electrical generation power plant there. You can see, as you look up to the north, up to the left, just an incredible array of lights. Because, you know, Israel is a very industrialized state now. It's an economic powerhouse. It's got all the contraptions of the modern state, all the cities, all the lights and all. And then you look to the right, and it's darkness. It's darkness as far as you can see, and that is Gaza. And it's Gaza is so severely impacted by the state of Israel. You know, Israel controls all of the electricity that goes into Gaza. It controls the water supply for Gaza. It really controls the resources that are needed to repair the frequent military attacks on Gaza, the latest big one being in 2014, where over 2,400 people of Gaza, many women and children, were killed by the 51-day attack, military attack, by the most sophisticated military really in the Middle East, the Israeli military, which uses Gaza as its testing ground. And essentially the U.S. is using Gaza as its military testing ground too, because the U.S. furnishes weapons and bombs that it is afraid to test itself on human beings because there would be the outrage. But they give it to Israel. For example, the dense inert metal explosive bomb, the dime bomb, that was used both in 2009 and 2014, that sprays some sort of a kind of a microscopic film, but it's a film that will amputate, will cut off arms and legs and slice off parts of people in a way that has never been seen before. And the Norwegian surgeons that were in Gaza and were treating these wounds have written extensively about this. So it's U.S. and Israeli military experimentation on the people of Gaza that makes us as American citizens say we've got to protest not only the Israeli government, but also our own government's complicity in what's being done to the people of Gaza, the 2 million people that now live there. It's incredible how the population is growing in Gaza, despite all of the horrific things that are happening to it. And yet the world really turns its back on Gaza.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Anne Wright about the women's boat to Gaza. Anne is an activist and former U.S. ambassador who resigned at the U.S. attack on Iraq in 2003, and she's continued to kick butt all around the world in terms of standing with the people, and I think it's extremely important. Now, Anne, you're raising, you know, one of the things that when you talked about the boat being stopped and seized in international waters, it raised the question to me of, like, look, there's a lot of risks that you and the other women took on those. What were some of those risks that you were aware of or that you were concerned about?
Well, we didn't know what the response of the Israeli military would be. We'd seen it in 2010 where they actually murdered people and wounded people. We've seen it as they've assaulted people on boats. They've tasered them. They've hit them with paint bullets. So we didn't know what the reaction was going to be, but we had prepared our passengers, our delegates, for the worst. We had gone through all sorts of nonviolence training and situations that have occurred in the past. So we made sure they realized that this could be a dangerous mission and it could be a fatal mission. In fact, one of the women that came all the way to Messina to see us off was the widow of one of the Turkish men who was executed on the Mavi Marmara. And to have her there to see us off really brought home the fact that these, you never can tell what young soldiers, and I, having been in the U.S. military for 29 years, I've trained them, I've been around them. You never can tell what young people with guns will do. And you can't tell what old people with guns can do either. So anybody with a gun and in a tense, stressful situation, and we knew that the Israeli military was going to tell these young soldiers or young sailors that, you know, these are terrorist women. These are just not a Nobel Peace Laureate. They're not just members of Parliament. They stand for terrorism against the state of Israel. So we knew the sailors would be tense. And even though we'd put out lots of publicity on who we were, our backgrounds, you know, you never can tell what it only takes one bullet to get something going. So we were prepared for the worst, and we were willing to do it. as a minimum, we knew that we were all going to face time in Israeli prison, and we were going to be deported from Israel, a 10-year deportation. So if you ever wanted to go back to the West Bank in solidarity with the Palestinians in the West Bank, you knew that it was going to be probably a lifetime ban. I don't think in any way Israel will ever let any of us who have been deported from Israel ever go back. And that means you are really giving up the opportunity to talk with personally, write articles about, and witness what the Israelis are doing to the people in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. Now, Anne, when you talk about all these risks, I have to ask you this because, and especially I was thinking about this, I was talking with my wife last night, I was saying, God, you know, Anne has been on so many of these trips, including the one on the Marvi Mar with the people who got killed, the nine people got killed, and I think one died later, like 4 years later. What was it, you know, what was it that compelled you folks to actually take these risks?
Well, when you see what the Palestinians are going through every single day, whether it's at the checkpoints and the apartheid wall, the illegal settlements in the West Bank, or you see that 2 million people are really imprisoned in a place called Gaza, and their whole life constricted and constrained by forces that they cannot control, it's like the least we can do is to call attention to this in some way. And the fact that it's dangerous, most people come to grips with it. I mean, you have to do it in order to go ahead and do these things, that you kind of make your peace with yourself and with others. Although most families are very upset that you go on these things, but, you know, it's a conviction within each person's heart that we who have privilege that are living in situations where, and particularly when we live in a country that is persecuting others, for example, those in Palestine, that it is our obligation to speak up and do more really than speaking up and going on these peaceful, nonviolent missions of on a boat. We go with a clean heart, a pure heart on it, and what the Israelis do, they're going to have to live with the rest of their lives. So we give them the option of treating us peacefully and hopefully changing their policies toward the Palestinians.
Now, and the mission of the trip was to break the blockade, not to bring material aid, as a lot of people would say many other trips in that kind of situation would be. You folks actually made the point that the mission of this trip was to break the blockade. Why this? Why is this mission of breaking the blockade so important?
Well, you need to say that there is a blockade. The mission was to bring international attention to the blockade itself. So we were intent on going to Gaza, breaking the blockade, going in solidarity with the people, knowing full well that the probability of us actually getting into Gaza was pretty low. But if you don't say we're going to try to break the blockade, then no media is going to cover you. It's really sad that the actual issue itself is not being covered. So you need to have things as dramatic as 13 women and a small sailboat sailing 1,000 miles across the Mediterranean to challenge the Israeli blockade.
But you also said, you said that in a way that this was to bring hope into this situation, which I thought was a pretty powerful statement as well.
Well, indeed it is. And when you see the reaction of the people in Gaza when they know another one of these boats, or maybe even two or three boats, or maybe even a whole flotilla of internationals have decided to spend lots of time raising funds to buy boats, to get them in good order, to invite people from around the world to be on them, and then finally sail them. All of this is a year-long process that is used in Gaza by educators, by human rights activists to give hope to the people in Gaza that we are not forgotten. And it really was powerful to see all of the things that were happening in Gaza. The young kids that were going out on the beach every day to make sand sculptures to welcome us to Gaza. The Women's Media Center that had a whole week of special workshop of now writing articles, and part of the media was artists making drawings of what it meant for the international community not to forget them. A group called We Are Not Numbers, which is a wonderful group of writers and artists in Gaza, did a whole series of videos and essays and photo exhibitions on what it means not to be forgotten. So in that way, we do bring hope, that we bring hope that the world is not turning their back on Gaza, and that the young people of Gaza, that the 2 million people, something like 48% of them are like under the age of 25. So you have a huge population there of young kids that want a life. They want a life without war, without attacks, without drones over them 24 hours a day. Despite all the problems that are caused for the people of Gaza, education still is one of the primary goals. And like 99% of the people in Gaza are literate. And these young kids, they want to go to high school, to universities. They want to get scholarships to be able to go to other parts of the world. So anything that we can do to give them some hope that they are not forgotten is really important.
Mm-hmm. All right, Anne Wright, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, me too. And let's stay in touch so I can find out what you're doing next, all right?
All right. I just came back from North Dakota.
I want to talk to you about that, yeah.
Yeah, powerful. Yeah. People, get in your cars and go to North Dakota.
All right, Anne. Thank you very much, and we'll be back in touch with you. Take care now.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Anne Wright on the Women's Boat to Gaza. And Anne's an activist and former U.S. ambassador who resigned from employment by the U.S. imperialists at the time when the U.S. launched its attack on Iraq in 2003. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Dr. J. Corey Williams talking about the oppressive seeds of the Colin Kaepernick backlash. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss that.
Pour that liquid down a man's throat.
Welcome back. That was Garland Jeffries with Truth Serum. All right. You know, everybody knows for the last, I don't know how long, since football season started, that there's been a whole hell of a lot of uproar over one particular thing involving football. And that has been something that people don't see often enough, in my opinion. And that's when Colin Kaepernick said he is not going to stand up and show pride in the flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. And that was in response to people actually demanding that he stand up. He put his hand over his heart for the national anthem and all this stuff. And he said, no, this is not something I'm going to do. Not while things exist like this today that I've seen going on. You want me to show pride in a country that oppresses black people and people of color, and it ain't going to happen. And that has unleashed a tremendous storm. These people have seen all kinds of racist attacks going on, fierce opposition. Well, I'm taking some of that from an article that I read in the wake of all this that really just kind of set me back. I was fascinated with that. I really thought it's an important article, and I wanted to talk to the author of the article. The article is The Oppressive Seeds of the Colin Kaepernick Backlash, and the author is J. Corey Williams. He's a resident physician in psychiatry at Yale University, and he's here to talk with us about it. Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let's talk about this. You know, Kaepernick's words and actions, you say, and response to them, a lot of times people just looked at that as sort of like, well, wait a minute, this is unprecedented. This is a watershed question. And you answered that, actually, no, it's not. Let's talk about what you meant by that. What's going on here?
I really found myself, Michael, thrown into this space of looking at the discourse around what was going on with Colin Kaepernick. And I was really struck by all the backlash and really ferocious criticism. I was taken aback by it. And I really think it struck a chord in a lot of people what he was doing. And this was not a sort of situation that happened in a vacuum. There's a long history here of specifically black athletes that stand up or speak out against the social and racial order. And it really strikes a chord in the sort of public consciousness of this country. And there's an entire history here that goes back generations to Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the Olympics in 1968 and Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson and other figures and the like. And I think this situation is in dialogue with those situations. And there's a visceral reaction that the public has to black men, specifically black athletes who stand up to the racial order. And there's a lot of layers to it.
You know, you talk about in your article that as a psychiatrist, you've studied how racial identity affects mental health. What are you talking about there?
Well, I think you're probably more of an expert on this than I am with, you know, the work that you've done in South Africa and the brilliant work that you've done in the past. But it's this idea that you really can't, you know, when I sit with a patient and I try to understand their experience, particularly people of color, you really can't separate their experience from their racial experience. Particularly African Americans in this country, there's a whole history of people trying to assert their humanity. And I really think that in large part, the history of African Americans in this country is in part an attempt to assert and reaffirm their own humanity in the face of a system which dehumanizes them. And so you hear these themes. You know, as a psychiatrist, I talk to people every day, particularly a lot of poor urban African American folks, who you hear these themes of oppression and feeling marginalized. Even in the same healthcare systems which I work, you know, having fears about the police and their communities, the things that they're seeing on TV in the context of the whole political climate right now. So racial identity is very much an essential part of someone's self-concept, and that's going to influence their mental illness, whatever it may be, whether it be depression or schizophrenia, you know, whatever their diagnosis may be. That is all informed by a sort of self-concept and a racial identity.
So it's really interesting, because when you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, you know, we just went through this whole thing around Nate Park and The Birth of a Nation. And I mean, here's a guy, in my mind, this man made a brilliant film, a film that is so powerful and so important that people see. And as soon as it starts to come out, suddenly a thing that he has been acquitted on, and something that he's actually tried to learn from, as he has spoke to it and all, in terms of the question of did he or didn't he rape this woman, sexually assault this woman many years ago. Unfortunately, the poor woman killed herself many years after that. And here's a man who was acquitted. That's all I got to say, is he was acquitted. But then this rode him and rode him, and it didn't come up again, ironically or interestingly enough. It didn't come up again until he made a film that really sort of sticks a hot poker right in the middle of everything today. I think it's extremely important. It teaches people a whole hell of a lot about the background of this country, but also what has been done to black people in the course of the history of this country. And I thought that when you're looking at this and you see this thing with Kaepernick and the rest of this, this is very heavy in relation to that.
Yeah, like I was saying, I mean, I think it really strikes some deep chords in the history of this country, number one, particularly in the context of American football that is seen as American as apple pie. And when you have an athlete, particularly an African-American athlete, that is using that platform for political expression, there's a whole question about patriotism. There was people in the media that were calling him a terrorist. It's this idea that to be a patriot and to have patriotism and to love this country, it means that you can't question it or you can't take a political stance. And I think it also speaks to this concept of white fragility, where particularly middle and upper class white Americans in this country, you know, their lives are not necessarily affected by race every day and have the privilege of not thinking about it. And so when you put them in a position where they're compelled and forced to think about race and how race affects their experience, it causes this kind of outrage. It makes people feel very uncomfortable. I mean, I received a fair amount of negative criticism and backlash just for my little article. You know, I can only imagine what a high-profile athlete is going through and the kind of backlash that he's going through. And I think people don't want to think that what they have or their privileges are because of a racial order or a social order. They don't want to think about the institutional racism and all of the things that have oppressed people of color in this country. People don't want to think that their lives are a product of that or that they benefit from that unjust system. And so when you put them in a position on NFL Sunday when they're comfortably sitting on the couch in their living room drinking their beers and eating their potato chips, and then you see an image of a black man sitting down during national anthem, I think it makes people feel really uncomfortable because they're not in that space. They're not ready to grapple with those issues. And I think sometimes it can really take on a kind of delusional experience where people just don't want to believe and they're choosing the reality that they want to live in by not acknowledging these issues.
In your article, you talk about, actually, it's not just the fact that there's identity affecting mental health, which is bad enough, and then all the stuff that you're just talking about now, but you also talk about that in the Kaepernick case, that what you saw was racially encoded messages about power, place, and punishment.
Yeah, there's a whole history in this country of the racial hierarchy and African-Americans traditionally being on the bottom of that hierarchy. And what comes with that is there needs to be a policing of boundaries. And when someone speaks out against that boundary, there is backlash and there's punishment. And I think that same reaction, that same urge to punish people who disrupt or seek to disrupt the racial order are punished. And you can look back and think about the thousands of African Americans that have been lynched in this country violently, Emmett Till being the most famous case. You can look back at the hundreds of years of I go so far as to call it American terrorism with the Ku Klux Klan and the angry, violent lynch mobs that preyed on the black community. And then you can transition into the Jim Crow era. And now you see a lot of writing and dialogue about mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex. So all these things are mechanisms by which people are subject to punishment if they act and speak or behave against the racial order. And I think Colin Kaepernick and the criticism that he received is in part in tradition with that mentality and a tradition with those racial attitudes that this country's had for so long.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. J. Corey Williams, a resident physician in psychiatry at Yale University, and we're talking about his recent article, The Oppressive Seeds of the Colin Kaepernick Backlash. You know, one thing that you bring up that I thought was really important, too, is that Jack Johnson, I'll just say those two words, that had a lot to do with what we're just talking about in terms of even the idea that you raised in the course of your article, the need of this society to tame the black man, you know, and all these things that are actually, that are put out there. What that really concentrated a lot in what happened to Jack Johnson. And I don't know how many people today actually know what happened there.
Yeah, I think it's tragic, you know, and first of all, I have to pay homage to, you know, the people that actually do this work on a daily basis. You know, I define myself primarily as a clinician, and I have some research interests, but, you know, people like Dave Zirin, William Roden, Josh, John Oberman, David Andrews, they study these kind of things and are a lot more kind of experts at this than I am. But I think it's tragic that a lot of our young people today don't know, you know, the history. And I think Jack Johnson is a perfect example of someone who was punished for doing things that disrupted the racial order. There's a sense of, you know, the black athletes, the few black athletes that make it to the highest levels of what they do, there's a sense that they're supposed to be grateful. They're supposed to be quiet, because they're afforded to make these millions of dollars and they're afforded fame and celebrity. And so people get angry in reaction if they act ungrateful or they act rebellious in any kind of way. And Jack Johnson was a perfect example of this, as, you know, as he was this phenomenal boxer who would defeat, you know, the majority of his opponents were white, and he would defeat them in such flamboyant and braggadocious fashion. And it really struck a chord with a lot of people, and so much so that after he defeated Jim Jeffries to win the title, Jim Jeffries was dubbed the Great White Hope because he was seen as someone who could defeat Jack Johnson and other black boxers at the time, and was seen as someone who was going to bring pride back to the white race. And after he was defeated by Jack Johnson, race riots spread throughout the country and caused this political uproar, so much so that the fight film actually was banned in a lot of states because of the anger and uproar that fight caused. And so I was just thinking about that in connection with the Colin Kaepernick situation, and I think there's a connection there.
Two things that you raised in the article is Du Bois talking about what happened with Johnson and the attacks on Johnson. He said they were a product of the unforgivable crime of blackness. And then the LA Times editorial quote, which I thought was extremely... If anybody thinks that there's not something bigger going on here, just knowing what that quote was, it was a message to black people that, remember, you have done nothing at all. Your place in the world is just what it was, speaking to Johnson's victory over the Great White Hope. Those two things, I think, concentrated a lot.
Right. And I think the whole Jack Johnson situation after he defeated Jim Jeffries, I mean, I think it really scared a lot of people because of what he represented. You know, he was, again, this braggadocious, flamboyant athlete who was standing up against the social order. And that victory, I think, really represented progress, black progress specifically. And I think that scared a lot of people that, oh no, things are going to change. Things might change. The LA Times, a major publication in this country, came out and said, this means nothing. You are where you have been, speaking to the black community, and do not look at this as a kind of achievement, I think was the subtext of that quote. And I think that it's a very telling quote. And I think that mentality really underlies a lot of the hatred and backlash that celebrity black athletes receive, such as Colin Kaepernick, when they do things in disruptive ways.
Now we have time for one more question. I wish we could just spend another half hour talking. Maybe we'll have to come back to this some point in the future, man. It'd be really good. But I did want to ask you one other thing, because there's the other side of all this, and that is the submissive black superstars in athletics and everywhere. You know, the submissive black person who's going to put out, even if they don't say it, but put out the example of, see, we can get by if you just try hard enough and you're just like good enough and you're just like sort of whatever, you care about this and you can make it. If you can't make it, then it's on you.
Yeah. I mean, the perfect example of that, and I mentioned it in the article, was Michael Jordan. I mean, he was, you know, as I was mentioning, your prototypical, just lovable, accepted black athlete. In part, it was because he had a way of being apolitical, of being non-disruptive to the racial order, of being tame in a way. And one of the quotes that I brought up was when, in an interview, he was asked why he didn't support a black Democrat in his state. And he replied, Republicans buy shoes, too. So in that sense, he had kind of reduced himself to a shoe salesman. At the opportunity to express some political agenda or talk about issues in this, that affected the black community in this country, and use his success in athleticism as a platform, like Muhammad Ali did, or like John Carlos did, or like Tommy Smith did, he appealed to his corporate interests. You know, he appealed to his brand name on his sneakers. And I think that actually spoke to people in the mainstream and allowed him to be so accepted, because he did not put people into an uncomfortable position of having to think about race, you know, having to think about, in, you know, social justice and the travesties that are happening in this country every day. And he allowed people to passively consume his sport, which was the NBA, obviously, when you could sit, you know, comfortably in your living room and watch basketball without having to think about racial justice, which is getting harder and harder to do with people like Colin Kaepernick speaking out against these issues.
Yeah, and that's for the good of all humanity, actually.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, Corey, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I definitely want to get back to you, man, at some point in the future. Let's continue this, because I think you have a lot to say on this, and I'd really like to explore it some more.
Yeah, anytime. I had a great time. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, thanks. Talk to you again soon, man.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. J. Corey Williams. He's a resident physician in psychiatry at Yale University, and he just wrote this article called The Oppressive Seeds of the Colin Kaepernick Backlash. It's really worth digging that article up. It was run in a number of places. If you just Google it, you'll find it. Dig it up, look at it, think about it, because it says a whole hell of a lot of truth. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just about come to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Henry Giroux, Ann Wright, and J. Corey Williams. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a little bit more from Garland Jeffries, Revolution of the Mind. Talk to you again next week.
Revolution, 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 revolution of the mind. Revolution, 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 revolution of the mind. Yeah. Everybody wants to feel things change. Everybody wants to see things be different. Everyone would like to see something new. Yeah, and everybody wants to see something true. Revolution, 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 revolution.